You're now locked in with New Models.
New Model Special Report.
Hello and welcome to New Models. I'm Lil Internet. In recent episodes, you've heard us mention the online marketplace of ideas, the project that Carly and I created with Joshua Citarella, together with the spatial design studio Sub, for the Strange Rules exhibition at Palazzo Dietro in Venice. The show, which was curated by Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst, Hans Ulrich Obrist, and Adriana Rispoli, presented practices that engage with the so-called protocol layer. In other words, the rules that determine how culture is created, transmitted, remembered. On this episode, we welcome back Joshua Citarella, artist, founder of the Do Not Research community, and for the past 2 years, host of the popular Doom Scroll podcast, which, as a media brand, is doing more than any American outlet right now to build a broad left voice that actually has a shot at shaping the country's political future. Here, we chat with Josh about the making of this online marketplace of ideas and how it operates in the context of capital A art. I'm Lil Internet, joined by my co-host Carly Busta. Our guest is Joshua Citarella. Let's get into it.
Hey, Josh.
Welcome back.
Hey.
Good to see you.
Joshua Citarella. Wow.
Carly, Julian. Hi, guys.
We were just together.
We just spent an intense, like...
What, almost...
2 weeks?
Yeah, week and a half.
Week and a half
in Venice.
Venice, Italy.
Right.
Yes. Not to be confused with Muscle Beach.
Right. Which would be a really great place to meet Josh, actually.
Do you lift in public, Josh?
No. Only in private. It's like gooning. What were we doing? Should we explain the project?
Yeah, well, we were installing something like 400 objects as part of a work that we called the Online Marketplace of Ideas. And Josh, what is the Online Marketplace of Ideas?
I've had this thought a few times whenever I embark on a project, and I think I said this to you guys when we were in the preliminary calls, but on the eve of doing something, I will think to myself, you know, this might be the best or worst thing I've ever done. So this certainly fit like right in the middle of that Venn diagram. And I've learned while carrying hundreds of pounds of books about internet culture up and down the flights of stairs of this medieval castle that I am on the receiving end of all of my practical jokes. So the online marketplace of ideas, as Carly said, is around, I think it's a little over 400 items. This is the memeplex of internet books, of theory, a Call Her Daddy baby doll tee, a Joe Rogan t-shirt, tote bags, hats, all of the ephemera and curia of internet culture curated together into this insane hot topic for the 21st century. People have probably seen these stories circulating on Instagram. It was a very extensive installation in collaboration with our good friends at Sub, Extraordinary Architects, that designed this deranged psycho Shopify concept store for us that we installed at Palazzo Dietro in a show called Strange Rules, curated by Matt Dryhurst, Holly Herndon, and Hans Ulrich Obrist.
With Adriana Rispoli from the Berggruen Institute, which runs the Palazzo Dietro.
I do want to mention my favorite item is a vintage t-shirt that in black letters on the front says, Alex Jones did nothing wrong, and then has the original InfoWars logo on the back. That is my favorite. And it was actually on eBay, unbought. I don't know how
historic object.
Certain treasures like this get overlooked, you know?
It's a timestamp.
Yeah.
Totally.
Because while we were installing it, Tim Heidecker is now, I don't know what his title is, the host, the creative director of InfoWars. The Onion has purchased the media property of InfoWars. And this kind of weird arc of internet culture of the last, let's say, like decade-ish, this thing is going to look very weird a few years from now. And InfoWars is like one of the most prominent voices in that space.
Yeah.
I mean, when we were conceiving of this project, we were very aware that we were scraping a certain moment in internet culture, gathering a representative sampling of its objects that would live together in perpetuity, or at least until we sell them as a big lot on eBay in the future, or whatever form it takes. And that was part of it.
Yeah, maybe a few logistical things to lay out, because I'm sure people have been bewildered seeing all of these images over social media. And we conceived of this show between the three of us basically in private, without the knowledge of the unbeknownst to them contributors to this show. So as a kind of deranged form of 21st century curator, i.e. consumer, we just purchased around 400 some odd items. Around 95% of the installation is just bought off of existing online e-commerce stores. And then like 5% of it is stuff from New Models, Do Not Research, our friends, artists, collaborators that are these emerging institutional structures that we see as potent players in the landscape of internet culture and media in the next few years.
I think Urbanomic also hooked us up.
That's some, true. Like, that's true. There are a couple of publishers who helped us out with some
found
deep
a copy
cuts.
Of Cute Accelerationism. So thank you,
that's
Urbanomic.
True.
Yes, there are a few deep cuts which had gone out of print, which friends gratefully hooked us up with. When we were talking about the exhibition at Palazzo Diedo, Julian, you phrased it in such a way as like, this is the unofficial American pavilion, that the primary export of American culture right now is pushing this internet ideology media out into the rest of the world. Maybe you could expand on that for people who haven't yet heard the lecture.
Well, it's like the American Pavilion at the Venice Biennale this year. It was curated by a woman who owns a pet store in
Tampa,
Florida.
It was curated by Jeffrey Uslip. It was the director of the pavilion, was this woman who was installed by friends of Trump last summer. And she's the pet food store owner.
Okay. And the artist was some guy actually lives in Mexico City who makes big bronze sculptures.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of a non-event, the American Pavilion. And I think our installation, actually, I mean, the Strange Rules show in general, there are quite a few American artists in it, or at least artists who engage with the American sphere of influence. I mean, I've started to think of the English language as this medium for the transmission of psyops and brainworms of all sorts. Like the United States now, especially since it dominates the digital stack, all of these very strange new ideologies, social norms, imaginaries are exported from the United States and its empire of abstraction. I wonder if you could even say that the U.S. soft power now, as its cultural exports have been challenged by Korea or Europe, that, these kinds of ideologies and the podcast sphere are kind of now its primary soft power export.
Yeah, all of the platforms come from California. They're all American, not just in where their headquarters are located and who owns them, but also in their philosophy of design, this kind of hyper-individualist. Yeah. And part of the themes of the show that Matt and Holly have been talking about is, let's go back to maybe the early 2010s, 2012, there's this mass adoption curve for Facebook and all these other platforms. And there's this kind of reckoning within cultural spheres that the individual creators, meaning musicians or journalists or artists, that those people have become less culturally influential than the designers of the platforms. So there's a strange thing that started to happen where, if you really wanted to have a big impact on culture, rather than releasing a grand opera or a wonderful novel or something like that, you would tweak some piece of code in this algorithm that then had all of these cascading effects for a mass audience. Part of our generation, part of the show, is like trying to reckon with what that means.
I mean, Josh, this reminds me of something that you've said, 2024 being the podcast election.
Yep. There is this strange inversion happening now where what we call alt media, incorrectly, I suppose, what we call alt media is now quantitatively larger than the legacy media. So this has been the case for nearly a decade now, but we don't even have the rhetorical tools to describe what this thing means. We're still kind of functioning in this outmoded language of counterculture, as if there is some kind of mainstream and an opposition. And I think the strange thing about the platforms is that everything has become counterculture. Everything has become oppositional. I'm recalling Carly's article in Document Journal a few years back.
Yeah, I mean, I think I take this from you. This is already almost 10 years ago, where any kind of counterculture that's playing out within these platform protocols is feeding the hegemonic structure. It's not countercultural. It's part of it. And so I feel like the model in my head has been a suburbanization of resistance. But I think, yes, the aggregate of all these seemingly disparate ideological positions, far more influential than any of, even in aggregate, the mainstream media channels. So like your CNN, your Fox News. I mean, it's interesting now hearing about the reformulation of Condé Nast. I was just listening yesterday to a podcast with the new CEO. The interviewer was asking him about, like, how do you contend with Substack or a good staffer wanting to start their own stream? And he's like, well, I think they'll find that the Condé Nast reach is superior. And it's like, is it? I don't know if that's true, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that's true anymore.
It's tough to slice the numbers because there may be some instances where it does quantitatively reach more. This is a very in the weeds thing about how you calculate these statistics and viewer duration and engagement or whatever. But baked into the numbers for legacy media, this is a little bit of a shithead example, but it's often playing in a doctor's office where it's just in the lobby,
totally.
It's in the waiting room, they have the news on, and they calculate all of those numbers as like highly engaged viewers who are influenced by this media. And so I guess in the model that we're looking at now is like, we are at this bizarre inflection point where as artists, as people who are working in the contemporary discourse, we're trying to make an exhibition that reflects this very unique, weird moment in which the countercultural oppositional figures have become the establishment. Like the people who thought that they were the opposition are now the incumbents. All of these things are screwy. The legacy and the alt media are switching places. So in the example of Gavin Newsom, my favorite friend of the podcast, Gavin Newsom has himself become the content creator in order to garner enough support and audience to later become the elected official. So the model through which these things are supposed to even work has become backwards. Whereas before, people were vying for these guest spots on things that reach, you know, hundreds of millions of people. Instead, they decided to just become the content creators themselves. So there's kind of two prominent examples to use. Gavin, he starts his own podcast. They have a sizable reach for a few episodes. It begins to trail off a little bit, but he has basically adopted this content creator, you know, mimetic inputs into the network, producing merch, posting in the style similar to Trump. And he's now considered the front runner for the Democratic Party. So this thing is in some way having a palpable effect. The other important example comes from Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico. She hosts a daily live stream called The Mañanera, quantitatively most watched media program in the country. She's speaking directly to her constituents. And so what I see starting to emerge here is some type of structural convergence. We're now at the strange moment where the content creators are best at getting the message out. They're also best at fundraising, and they're also best at what we call calls to action, meaning turning people out to canvas, protest, vote in certain ways. Imagine for a moment, if you will, a massive CSV file that has the extensive audience list for a Substack or a podcast or what have you. Yeah, we're starting to see the political figures themselves just like converge into this media political singularity. And I think that gives us reason to take all of these entities, magazines, podcasts, what have you, as a kind of accidental avant-garde that is going to be incredibly potent and influential in the next few years.
Yeah, they're not doing something actively to denature the system or to like destabilize the system. They're like avant-garde in the sense that like they're acting out of a kind of survival instinct as to what has the most agency. This idea of being agentic, Sam Chris talks about, he had a great piece about being agentic. And I love this idea of like the creative political singularity where a politician, their foremost cultural node, podcaster, poster, blogger.
I mean, it's just basically like rappers have been for the past.
I guess so, right.
Years.
They like understood how to like clout bomb.
You cannot become a like successful rapper unless you are a really good influencer, content creator first. Right.
And you couldn't be a good rapper until you had everybody in your
neighborhood.
In the music video.
Of course,
like your music, your song would
if
not.
If you don't have 50 guys in your music video, no one, you're not going to make it because you got to have that social proof.
Right. Think of like Mamdani is also that. And, you know, if you think back to like the troll merch stores of Trump and then the Biden team tepidly trying to also be funny and just like it not hitting. I mean, Julian and I have been very interested in this idea of neo-orality, where as the information, the text space becomes so overloaded, the screen space, the visual space becomes so overloaded, you want to listen to people metabolize news and tell you what they think with an emotional vector, hear people in conversation. Mm-hmm. And there is a strong correlation to the way our information space is changing, the way the feed conducts us affectively. In any case, I mean, the material precipitate of that is still merch, merch and books. We sort of cheekily called the books doctrine. Because very often you would have like Marc Andreessen writing the Techno-Optimist Manifesto. It's why you have Alex Karp writing his story. And this doctrine becomes this kind of idealized form of merch that backfills it with an ideological aspiration.
But at the same time, I mean, you have even Palantir making merch, right?
Right.
It's also these things that are so substantial in the metaverse. It's kind of the only way they can reach out and be visible in body space, right?
Right. But critically, they're done in these very small runs. Like I imagine for Palantir, it's like 1,000 pieces or something. For someone smaller, it would be like 100 pieces. Like Red Scare makes 100 pairs of shorts. I'm not sure what the actual number is, but enough that it would immediately sell out and become this like cult object. Like the Palantir merch that happens right after a girls' school in Iran gets bombed 3 times. Like why would you put a merch drop out after that? And who is the person who buys it? And what is the meaning of those objects? It's so cynical.
Yeah, I guess the NFTs didn't really work introducing scarcity into the digital environment. So merch it is.
Well, when these creators post their merch onto the network, it kind of does 2 things. One, there's a limited drop. So it's like a source of revenue in the most narrow sense that it's profitable to have scarce collectibles. But 2, they also work on this mimetic layer, on the content layer, where I think of the Tucker Carlson merch, for example, like I'm sorry I said you were a Fed or PSYOP critic or all of these kind of like very meme-y pieces that they put out in the last few months. They function as advertising. They function as a point of discussion. They're kind of working in both layers at once. But on the topic of merch, I wanted to address something that Carly, you had brought up when we were installing the show. It's something specific to the millennial generation that a lot of our keepsakes and possessions and our like cultural sense of who we are is not physical or material. Like if I think of my parents' generation, if you had good taste, you could accidentally wind up with a very valuable record collection at some point. And everything we have is kind of like in the cloud or on the phone, or we don't even have like albums to look back on. But yeah, maybe merch fulfills this kind of other important role now that is different than generations in the past.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I joke that the thing that we're leaving our daughter are like Rubbermaid storage containers full of podcast t-shirts. Like, that's terrible. Yeah. What claim is that to what kind of, I don't know, dowry or what kind of, what's the word? Not dowry. What's the word?
Endowment, inheritance.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, millennials cohabitate. They sublet, they move around a lot, they don't have basements, they don't have sheds. Generally, they're not accumulating a lot. Most of it is digital. The one thing they'll do is a t-shirt or a book or a bumper sticker, a pin, maybe they have a bong. Like these are the agentic material objects of millennial and younger generations. Mm. Like these are the traces that we're carrying with us through life.
Yeah, yeah.
And thanks to Matt Dryhurst also for donating some choice objects from his collection. I was heartened to see that he and Holly also have this same, they have Rubbermaid filled with the first Ethereum shirt or, you know, these kinds of weird objects. Yeah, of course, the archival value of this stuff is probably way less than our parents' like Chinese curio chest that they've held on to since the 70s.
It's not appreciating in the same way.
I don't think so, yeah. But, well, I will say, though, that Do Not Research hoodies are going for like more than $300 on eBay.
Okay, so that was
actually a
surprise.
Books as well that like...
Some of the books are
the
valuable.
The number of books that I've lost that I look up later and they're like $800 on Amazon.
Yeah, that is... That's true, that's true. I wanted to mention... One of the things that I started to notice when we gathered this enormous 400 plus some odd materials is that there is a kind of formal similarity between a lot of these works. So my favorite example when we were standing in the space was that there was a tote bag from the Young Turks and t-shirt from Sam Harris, and they both utilized a familiar graphic design that if you're in New York and you get takeout Chinese food, it says like, thank you, thank you, thank you. People will know this bag.
Oh, yeah.
But they have that rough design printed on this tote bag and on the t-shirt. But they espouse, you know, on some issues, very divergent, polar opposite positions, yet they're using the same kind of graphic motifs. And on top of that, there's a material similarity between all of these different works where there's Yugo hats, Gildan t-shirts, they use DTG embroidery. There's like a kind of suite of tools and a pretty seamless logistical infrastructure that connects these digital websites to warehouses in the real world. And I think on this, you know, broad topic of counterculture that we were discussing before, there's something else that when you see the exhibition in its totality, you can start to see what I would describe as a market hegemony, meaning that all of these different options that espouse different editorial positions that are functioning on what Carly calls the content layer, they have a limited range of influence, but there seems to be this underlying economic megastructure, for lack of a better term, that is uniting all of these things. And if we can see them all at once, then maybe we can start to visualize what that new megastructure might be, right? Like, what is the platform economies and stacks that are allowing these things to happen? And how does that become its own form of hegemony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can see the supply chain that allows the Gildan t-shirt or the Eco Stanley and Stella version of that. You can see that as baseline material support, the way we used to think of like the white cube gallery system. Like, you have a painting of a certain size, it's flat because it goes into a gallery and it flows through that supply chain well. Now you have the t-shirt, which from the sourcing of the cotton to the production in either Turkey or China, depending on your supply chain, to the tariffing, to the shipping. You can pack a t-shirt flat. You can send it in a mailer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is also, I should say, like, Josh, do you want to speak a moment about like the logistical hula hoop we had to like spin in order to like bring, how many different Amazon accounts did
the
we
hula
use?
Hoops
like, it's actually kind of
enormous duffel bags, as heavy as we are. Yeah. I mean, this really is like a perfect kind of timestamp of internet culture. If internet culture is like the apex of the project of globalization, we timestamped it at the very end where now InfoWars is done. Tim Heidecker is the host of InfoWars, has been purchased by The Onion. And also all of these tariffs exist to kind of prevent the seamless shipping logistics that were characteristic of the last decade plus, let's say. And those things also, because of their nature of being international and seamless and very low friction, they also just drove down the margins on what all of the creators could earn from their merch, from whatever they produced. And that made them increasingly more sensational and inflammatory and divisive and, you know, breaking off in all of their already exaggerated, radicalized corners. So it was the perfect moment to be able to do it. But for us, again, we're on the receiving side of our own practical joke, where we had to figure out how to move all of these things. And in some cases, you're just bringing a very, very heavy bag onto the plane with you.
Right. I mean, the fact that we were going to actually do this piece only really was like solidified in, I want to say, late February. I think there was one phone call where it went from, oh, maybe we could talk to the shop at the Diado to sell some of this stuff that's a precipitate of the Web2 protocol layer. Wouldn't that be cute? To the shop being like, hell no, this is Venice. And, you know, for people who haven't tried to produce something in Venice, know that like everything has to arrive on these little boats cardboard boxes. Like, the city of Venice, historically as a merchant city, had a very strict system of what districts could trade what kinds of objects, because the boat to, let's say, warehouse structure was really refined to say, okay, here's where grain goes, here's where fur goes, here's where silk goes, so that you don't have a mixing of certain things that would be, I don't know, adversarial to each other. When we set out to actually make this happen, first we hired an amazing production assistant, Elena Zagas, who helped us do this.
Thank you, Elena.
Two, we realized that we could do Italian Amazon, we could do German Amazon, we could do American Amazon for the mimetic value of the American covers, but we're introducing tariffs and also a time lag. But okay, let's enact all of these different Amazon accounts, which of course are tied to certain personal identities, and then shipping, like, I don't know, 50 pounds of t-shirts to Josh, similar to us in Berlin. I mean, the aggregation of all these objects was actually like a very bizarre logistical problem to solve.
Yeah, the total cost of everything, because this, I mean, there's a lot of items in this store, but the total cost of everything was really not that much. It was the administrative burden. I mean, we set up a real material puzzle of moving very affordable or cheap objects across borders with tremendous friction right at this point of deglobalization. So it was kind of like a, yeah, we're seeing the theory in practice right now.
Yes. And I think also walking into the room, you really get this feeling that you don't get from the spreadsheet of like, whoa, this is crazy. It's like the first time you walk into like an anarchist or a cult bookstore. It's just like way too much. Yeah. And it all feels kind of threatening in some way. But looking at it all in the same room, all of these 400 plus objects, there was something about it that you also realize how incoherent the political landscape of the U.S. is now because of this. And I keep coming back to like, you know, people talk about the K-shaped economy, but I start to see like K everywhere now, like Mark Fisher, prescient as always, like it does feel like a K-punk era, K meaning like the K-shaped economy. Of course, all the ketamine everyone's doing, but also like you look at this and there is this K-shape of everyone's using the same platforms to distribute their podcasts and everything. Everyone's using the same merch form and processes and companies. And then you, on the one end, you have this extreme consolidation. And then on the other end, you have like this total decentralization and just like kind of Cambrian explosion of media entities. And then similarly, there's like the Uniparty of the United States, like voters and the democratic process has nothing to do with supporting Israel or whether or not you'll get universal healthcare. Like those are foreclosed entirely from the democratic process. But on the other end, like what people's ideologies or political beliefs are,
or it's identity just or whatever.
It's just so
you can be whoever you want to be, so long as you like never get sick and support Israel.
I mean, And I mean, this is actually, I even think about Josh, your practice these days, you know, when critique of you is, oh yeah, Doomscroll's just, it's a centrist op. And I started to think about how like centrism is kind of just a slur for somebody trying to make a coherent politics that like might actually attract a critical mass necessary for
somebody's
the
actually
democratic
aware,
process.
And listening to the different sides and trying to just like,
you see it across the spectrum. Yeah. This is not even a left or right thing. You look at how MAGA's just fragmented, right? And Trump is doing things totally outside of his base now. He's basically like, I mean, surprise, surprise, a lifelong liar and scammer, lied and scammed. But yeah, there's this.
Capital doesn't make sense. Capital also feels really schizophrenic. It's like you have all this job loss and yet the market continues to go up because company valuations go up. Right. I mean,
right.
It seems K-shaped, like a lot
the
of things.
Magnificent Seven of the market. Right. And I mean, I don't know. There's, I just see K everywhere now these days. But you feel that incoherence when you step into the room. You can see that K shape at work.
Yeah. I feel like there's, well, if I can respond to being called a centrist for a moment. I've gotten used to it at this point. I've been called centrist and extremist, conservative, progressive, whatever people want to paint me as. I think that there was a vision when all these processes started. Like, I think that there was a kind of utopian, idealistic end for what the platforms would bring us to, right? So just picking up on kind of what Julian laid out about this, the Cambrian explosion, the editorial incoherence of all of these different positions that are espoused in the content layer here. I think that
it's Cambrian
in the process
with a K,
of,
by the way.
Cambrian with a K. That's good. I'm going to use that. The vision that like by unleashing all of these editorial opinions and removing the old gatekeepers, right? Like putting everything up into the clear net of Web 2, that this was going to allow people to voluntarily organize, find their own tribe, what have you. Those things have started to take on this new meaning. And I think that they're building experiments towards institutional structures that will be very potent in the 21st century. But I think that if you go all the way back, like there kind of was a utopian vision at the core of this like a neoliberal imaginary going back to like the 1940s of a global society where the distribution of resources and how people would interact with each other was through a frictionless market. And so I saw like the platforms as trying to instantiate that thing in a kind of clearly distilled, crystallized version that was in code and was imperfect, but it had this kind of optimistic imaginary. And I feel like as people who are progressives and would describe themselves as being opposed to that vision, we kind of just let it happen and cheered it on along the way. Like we in many cases said that this is a good thing and unfettering all of these opinions, this will lead towards more progressive ends and more positive outcomes for society. And I think that we missed the reorganization of materials in the world that the platform economies have now thrust us into. So when you walk around these, you know, in some cases, really radical ends of the political spectrum, like you're seeing crazy far right stuff and far left t-shirts that are produced through the identical just-in-time delivery, on-demand printing, same material production, that is really where power is located and where surplus value is being extracted. So I think we allowed the neoliberals to, we did their dirty work for them. We bought that vision and now we're in this new world. And part of the chaos and the incoherence of coalitions like MAGA and whatever are us trying to make sense of that original neoliberal vision of this unified society where everyone interfaces through markets. And we're seeing the return of states and the return of institutions. The kind of long arc of this is, you know, we've been talking about this stuff for God knows how long, right? Like the stack was written in 2015 talking about platform sovereignty and all of these themes. But if you are peripherally aware of these developments that are unfolding, what we have attempted to do for better or worse and in varying degrees of success is to use the communities around New Models and Do Not Research as a kind of counterexample to this neoliberal teleological trajectory, for lack of a better term, this neoliberal development of society that leads us all into these kind of niche atomized tribes, is that we built these collective enclaves. And you can make a positive example of these institutions that are less extractive, that are much more cooperative.
I think there's always this cycle, though, of dispersion and consolidation.
Oh, right.
And I think we're right in this like dispersion moment of everything kind of breaking apart into these different little silos. And I think maybe we're at the beginning of a consolidation, and this is where the new institutions will be formed.
How do you see it, Josh? And like, you speak a lot about para institutions. You think of DNR and New Models to some degree as that. Lots of people within these communities also run different kinds of para institutions. But what's your definition of a para institution? Sometimes I feel like that term is almost too, like, it's so hard to think of institution as something other than like in its most open form, like rhizome or something. Like when you say institution, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, when I say institution, I mean any group of people in which decisions about production, what they write, what they publish, what they make together is deliberated around a table. As a contrast to platforms where there's no deliberation, there's no gatekeeper, there's no room for democratic negotiation about what we're going to do together, and people just upload their own individual, you know, whether they write a novel, whether they, they're a journalist, whether they make a podcast, what have you. So for better or worse, like I think a lot of the rhetorical tools that we've absorbed by being in the art world is from the realm of institutional critique, where, you know, these things are totalitarian and the gatekeepers are corrupt and yada, 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 the kind of conversation we've had for the last 20 years on these topics.
Yeah.
But in embracing the platform as the alternative to those internal problems of institutions, we've just liquidated all of them. Like we just got rid of them. We didn't actually fix the problems and we lost that space for democratic deliberation around the table. In reference to the institutions and pseudo-organizations, I mean, we have a handful of different terms for them. So para-institution, pseudo-organization. I mean, I think we say that now because they're nascent. They're not yet fully formed, right? But I think there's a trajectory at which they will become very influential. And we're starting to index a few different examples of like where the para-institution or pseudo-political party has more of an impact than the legacy political party. And so that's kind of the analogy I'm trying to draw here with the quantitative reach of alt media versus the smaller reach of legacy media, that these things have kind of flipped. And I'm proposing that there may be a version of that in the future where the pseudo-political party actually outperforms the legacy political party. Examples of these things now that we see brewing included in the show is the American Communist Party, which is a, you know, very fringe organization founded by a few Twitch streamers. They attempted to infiltrate the CPUSA, the Communist Party of the United States. They were blocked from ascending into the positions of leadership, so they formed their own splinter party. This is, you know, what always happens with wacky people on the left. But maybe some more examples for this. Emerging institutions, as Yancey says, universities, guilds, and cities in some countries. So the cities and countries like the Seasteading Institute, like Praxis, like all of these types of libertarian exit projects. But universities, it would be hard to say that that's incorrect, because we now literally offer courses through Do Not Research, where we're paying people better than the rate that they get as an adjunct professor at a, you know, accredited university. Wow. So those rival structures, I'm inclined to take them seriously. You know, I don't think that the legacy universities can compete on statistics of job placement anymore. So if you're competing on the satisfaction of the individual participants in the program, it would be hard to not take a $49,995 deduction on the cost for some of these things. Yeah, so I'm inclined to take them seriously and to look at these as like very influential forces in the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we take Jacqueline Fent at her word that we now live in a vibocracy, that these more nimble and often personality-driven, oftentimes the center of these para-institutions, if not a single individual, is like a community personality. Like DNR has a community personality. New Models has like a community personality. I think we included a few like pop star type figures, like Charlie XCX's Brat is in there. Mm-hmm. I think there's like a Dorian Electra DVD. There's a Grimes t-shirt. Things that were just sort of, you know, people who were just sort of internet adjacent, but who have also at times conducted the vibe of a swarm. And that seems to be the critical skill here, is to be able to orient people around a certain, I mean, I say vibe and I know that sounds like I'm talking about like an influencer in the sun drinking a matcha latte or something, but like we've on our podcast have talked to a bunch of scholars who are actually looking at the shape of vibe in information space. Like it actually shows up as a mathematically objective object, which is so fascinating. And Sal Hagen, Daniel Tazou, who were recent guests, are looking at kind of like a Lefebvre rhythm analysis of how feeds conduct people and individual institutions more than like, yes, they have a course offering and it's coherent and it identifies you with a certain community, but they also are generating a certain kind of rhythm and vibe in digital space, which is like keeping a community oriented towards that signal. Like it's actually happening on this other kind of precognitive level. And this is why, just if anyone's wondering, like, why do we include like a Brat flag? That's so cringe. Or why do we include like a Grimes t-shirt in the show? It's because these figures, they above all, they conduct a vibe. And that's
an audience
through it. And that's the critical skill.
Is there an element of maybe a soft technological determinism included in the exhibition? Julian, you made this poster that is the founding code to 4chan. And you can kind of see the social impact wherever that is deployed in whatever country at whatever year. Yeah. Do you want to speak about that for a little bit? Because I don't know if people are familiar with the backstory.
Yeah. Well, this came out of really thinking about the central concept of the show Strange Rules, about the protocol level being the site of consequence. So the source code that 4chan runs on was originally made by an anonymous guy in Japan in 2001. And then Moot, a few years later, translated it from Japanese into English and deployed it to start 4chan. And what's really interesting, it's under 1,000 lines of code. I made this poster. The entire source code of 4chan is just fits on this poster. And I mean, you think about what came out of that platform and what came out of the physics that was inherent in that code. I mean, it was every meme for a 15-year period, basically.
Came from 4chan,
yeah. Right. As well as all of these weird right-wing, far-right movements and incel movements, all of which, very interestingly, had very similar analogous movements earlier in Japan, emerging from Futaba.php, which is the name of the original source code. I fit it all on a poster that I imagined to be like a poster from the future looking at 21st century protocol weapons. And it kind of just has the full source code on it and a bit of description of all of those ways that similar phenomenon emerge from this zero order physics of that social environment and how it conducts social activity.
Yeah, to try and tie a few things together here, approaching like a thesis statement for the show, if you change the rules, you change the subject, right? This is the
exactly
that's what you're going to
say.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah. The subject so meaning this, like the subjectivity, the person. The subjectivity, right?
The individual,
the living entity.
Yeah. And so that the 4chan source code is kind of the perfect example of it, because you deploy those few lines of code, and then the downstream social effects are pretty visible and similar in every country where it's tested. One of the things that I want to head off, because I think people are going to legitimately ask, why do you think that these institutions are going to emerge? Just everything's going to be shredded and broken apart through the atomizing forces of the internet. I think we bring some outdated millennial assumptions to these conversations, where if you were to look at the early adopter benefit that we all got as, you know, art students or graduates, we outnumbered in our follower count the incumbents that we were competing against, like the big galleries, the big artists that were late to adopt social media. But in this kind of unbundling cycle where everyone was shed from their magazine to their individual Substack, try starting one of those things now. It's really flooded. The zone is flooded with competition. And so what we're seeing is people squad up, meaning like they join New Models, they join Do Not Research, they publish collaboratively and collectively. And that is actually, in your own individual interest, the best way to advance your career and your projects. And so we're seeing a macro shift of the incentives. What we're trying to evidence through this exhibition and talking about the rules that produce the position that we're in now with all of these radicalized people and everything else, that we need to start thinking about, dare I use the phrase, new models to develop new institutions for the 21st century that we are trying to prototype through our efforts, blood, sweat, tears, and everything else.
I love that.
Do you want to maybe reflect on, I was thinking to myself, you know, a big part of this exhibition is like the chaos of 2016 up until 2026. What is it going to be like if we open the arc in 2036, for example? How are you going to look back on all of these insane objects and ephemera of internet culture?
Something that occurred to me while we were doing the show, and something that you've discussed further, Julian, is with vibe coding, even if like people are squatting up on their Substacks, I think we're going to see a further dispersion and decentralization when it comes to app infrastructure and the internet itself. Like during the past 10 years, places like Do Not Research and New Models emerged as a way to get outside of the dominant ClearNet platforms. But I think we're going to have a total proliferation of social apps. And the innovation, I think, is going to be in, I mean, the same thing that we said like 10 years ago when it came to these dark forest communities, inroads that connect these different apps and communities in ways that feel healthy. The unbundling is going to be really exciting. No one likes social media. I mean, actually, Julian, you also have one foot in the music world doing stuff on like a larger scale with social media. Temperature check. What do people feel about the current platforms that produced many of the positions that are represented in this show?
I mean, everyone hates it. Like music marketing at this point, to just like crack the algorithm and get a new song in front of the right people, the marketing companies and music PR firms have essentially just become the equivalent of whatever that Russian state troll farm is. Like they run fake accounts. They have networks of like hundreds of meme pages.
Everything's AstroTurf.
Yeah.
Everything is AstroTurf. You pay them and they push it out to like 10 million people. And that's how it works, which is technically illegal and against the TOS. But they realize it's just the only way to actually do it.
I mean, so, Rat was astroturfed initially, right? And then it organically took hold.
And but it is so expensive to hire a firm. Like, so many artists are like, I don't want to post anymore. I don't want to do it. I just don't want to do
it.
Like,
let's pay for, like, mafia protection.
And you end up paying people so much money because the artists themselves don't want to be on social media, and they'll pay a premium just to not have to touch it, right? I know someone who is working with musicians on social media, and they have a separate phone just to do their work on social media so that they can stay away from it when they don't have anything to do. Right. I mean, so with vibe coding, I think it's feasible to design a good social media platform for a niche interest and to find that kind of perfect in-between space of the right number of people where it feels special. I don't know, maybe how early MySpace felt or early any social platform
felt. And there's also that phone, that nothing phone. Cathal in our Discord says that he's been using one for 2 years and he says it's great. You can design your web experience yourself.
I actually have this conspiracy theory that's related to this, which is, I think that, I mean, and you look at the ideology of all of the American tech oligarchs, and it's very much this, like, accelerationist, everything's going to fragment into autonomous city states or something, right? And I think the reason why they're accumulating so much capital is because they do expect in the future, with things like zero knowledge proof, where you can be anonymous and verified at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no reason why someone can't vibe code an open source Uber that just replaces Uber, right? All of these platforms that just basically became middlemen in every aspect of your life, it becomes very feasible to design an open source free alternative to it. And I wonder if the tech oligarchs actually do project out and say, oh, well, our time of monopolizing this middleman space is limited and we need to get $1 trillion so that we can escape to New Zealand before all of this collapses. But
very possible. Yeah. The monopoly set up by Web2, I think it's a very fair criticism that a lot of these things that were lean competitors have just become rent extractors. They're now drains on the economy. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very fair assessment.
Yes, it's profit slop. It's just profit without production.
Yancey is building something, DeFos, Dark Forest operating system.
Yeah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, just very briefly, because it's still in development. But yeah, we are now like, you know, where is New Models? Where is Do Not Research? We're kind of siloed between Substack, Patreon, Instagram. Like, we've got these different interlocking parts. But in this suburbanization model, as you laid out before, DeFos would be this one-stop shop where you've got all of those independent functions built into the same thing, and you can collect these communities. The part about it that I think is really exciting, because, you know, there's different publishing tools where you can build similar things like this, but you can also build in micropayments and remuneration for all of your contributors, like, and stuff like that. Yeah, but kind of like a personal cul-de-sac of those things rather than something that operates at state capacity.
Right.
And if you're in a model of the internet that's increasingly hard to browse and like your Web2 feed is just filled with AI slop and clickbait, these are just like much more pleasant ways to go about your experience coordinating with friends. So, you know, it seems kind of inconsequential now, but then when you're starting to work with a blog like DNR that's now published some 400, 500 people almost. Like,
wow.
There's a lot of stuff to keep track of. And those things at scale, they become really, really important. So, you know, ways to keep track of membership. I think in a crisp real world example, this is one of these new models, new institutions that is a net positive for society rather than some of the other stuff we've seen in the last 10 years. On that note, is it maybe appropriate to look back on what we might expect to, if we open this arc in 2036, like, what are we going to think about all of these insane internet t-shirts and ephemera?
I mean, I hope it jogs our memory. I mean, the problem is that the internet mulches any sense of chronological time. And so I think
it's an amnesiac space.
Yeah, I think it will be useful. And I mean, it's why we keep these containers full of t-shirts, is that it's something we have to remember, oh yeah, that summer when I went to that show and we had that night, and or like, I loved that album and I listened to it during this time in my life. And I think we won't get all the jokes. I think like some of that will fade away. You know,
the 6-7 t-shirt will be meaningless.
The 6-7 in. Yeah. Like, what the heck? Right. And I think it'll be interesting to see, will we be able to see a kind of global aesthetic? Like, there's a moment in the show where we see this planet reference again and again and again, a planet on fire, a planet that's extended, a planet that's like abundant, you know, like, will there be certain motifs which will be set into relief for us? Yeah, like, where will the humor sit? I mean, maybe 10 years isn't long enough. Maybe it's much longer. I'm not sure. Like, what will 10 years even feel like? Like, I can't believe that the financial crash was 20 years ago. I mean, that's just an insane thing to think.
Yeah, and I mean, 10 years ago kind of feels the same as now, except I had a far poorer understanding of how this new environment
or
works.
Or a far better understanding of what you thought you knew, and then you realize that it doesn't work that way any longer. I mean, what about you, Josh? What do you, more than us, you're deeper into these cultures.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, climate, super important and incredibly influential. That will be, maybe the biggest thing to look back on, because it's totally disappeared from the conversation right now.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think in the 10-year frame, you know, having started this work, started publishing in 2018, it's been like 8 years now. And I look back through stuff that I published in like 2019, 2020, and you could see the first timestamps and seeds of like a Nick Fuentes type of character, like literally Nick Fuentes,
you know,
interview the people who are in these content streams that are now pretty potent influential forces. So I feel relatively confident that there will be 10 years from now, certain people who are much more influential than we today give them credit for. And I'm hopeful that some of the things that now seem absurd and dangerous, you know, like potent forces, will also in hindsight be like, oh, that thing never came to fruition. How silly we were to think that that was a, you know, potential model of the future. I have certain examples in mind. I'm not going to mention names, but yeah, some things that hopefully will dissipate and we can look back on fondly as like a hallucination of the 2026 ecosystem. One thing I know absolutely for certain is that Coco will inherit the absolute best t-shirt collection of any toddler in Germany. So that I feel extremely confident in all my predictions.
I mean, I did like this idea of merch being the oldest form of consensus technology, which predates the internet and which will potentially, if our storage containers hold, it will also outlast the internet potentially. I do like that idea that if the data centers don't get built and World War III ramps up, we may only be left with these hard to discern strange objects.
What did this sign or logo even mean?
Right. What does it even mean? I mean, it was a discussion that we had when we were aggregating things. Like, many people won't be able to read most of this stuff. And like, I had this memory of speaking to two older, very well-heeled French women who pointed to the Hikikomori condition Romelia t-shirt and were like, what is this? Where do I begin?
I mean, it is interesting.
The layers.
It is interesting to see people navigate it, though, when they enter. I mean, there's some people came in and they were like, in 2 seconds, ew, no thanks. Trump, what? MAGA, no thank you, bye, and walk out.
Right.
And then other people come in and they have totally mind mapped this whole like secret, deliberate pattern and placement that the entire show, everything is in every place for a reason, because there's all these secret relationships between them. Like, there's like
Apophenia.
This apophenia possibility there with all of the objects. In a way, it's interesting. It's kind of like watching someone navigate a feed in real physical space.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
You really do feel a unique sense of information overload in a non-screen context in a way that I don't think, like, I know it was a distinct feeling I had that I don't think I've had before or very rarely ever have that feeling.
Yeah.
Of course, you all kind of built it, so I don't know if you were like a frog in boiling water and didn't get that feeling by the time it was done. I came after it was already installed to some degree. And
there was a moment where it started to look
cool
and people would come in and they would be like, oh, cool. And I was like, okay, but that's actually not the response we want. We need to be like, oh my God, this is psychotic. And I actually think that had we been given like another few days and a few more DHL shipments, I think it could have taken on even more, but potentially we would reinstall this.
Right.
In another form in the future. And would we keep what we have and add to it? Would we do the whole process again? I mean, these are open questions, but it's an interesting format. I haven't heard responses from people outside of our immediate network, which means either this is just something that happens to be interesting
except
to our
except for the
sector.
wonderful Eddie Frankel at The Guardian.
That's true, who did
who
call it
brilliant.
We got it mentioned in Days, too.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
Gonzalez was very positive about the piece.
Okay, cool.
Can I throw in one thing about, yeah. Now that we're like sufficiently into the podcast, I can rip on these people. People who would like walk in and be like, Trump, MAGA, ooh, like this now has majority Democratic support. These channels are larger than the legacy institutions that they inherited and dedicated their lives to building. These things are now steering not just culture, but politics.
Yes.
And that revulsion, that response from people who are in these elite positions within those institutions is part of why the institutions have become literally out of touch with their political constituencies.
Oh, 100%.
That revulsion is the evidence of them being out of touch. And so the kind of double-pronged approach here is that as cultural influence has moved away from these museums and cultural institutions and what have you over to the platforms, you see a similar type of disconnect. Like these two things are actually mirroring each other.
Yeah.
And so I think part of what we're trying to do is to reflect to the art world how ugly and chaotic and dysfunctional all of society has become because our institutions have drifted out of touch with their constituencies and with their publics. So yeah, that kind of response, good. Let them have it. You know, that's like they built this entire system that ground artists down to where they're living at the poverty level in a society without health insurance or social democratic infrastructure. They can be upset for a few minutes, you know? This is evidencing the state of culture and the world that they built and hope to maintain. If they don't like it, then too bad. That's the people have had their democratic say. So as a centrist, I'm just trying to hold society together right now and heal the political divide, you know? That's really what I'm trying to
do. I mean, I will say, like, listening to the New York Times, the interview podcast, and listening to Tucker Carlson and
incredible.
I mean, incredible.
When's Tucker Carlson coming on Doom Scroll,
yeah,
Josh?
Steve Bannon first, probably, but yeah, one day.
Damn.
One day. Got to learn from the best.
Even post Epstein, Steve Bannon. That's hardcore.
Steve Bannon makes a lot of sense.
That's really tough.
But as soon as Tucker reads Exocapitalism, it's over. He's going to get so skizzed out on such. It's going to be amazing.
He's already haunted by demons. You know, he's definitely in the pipeline for it.
It's a book he needs and he doesn't know it. I swear to God.
Someone send Tuck Exo.
Somebody get Exocapitalism
please.
And Tucker
right.
Carlson's
in
hands.
Hand, totally. But what I was going to say is that the New York Times, the gray lady, this ultimate institution, becomes a foil for individuals who, I mean, Tucker Carlson would call himself non-aligned, but who's the guy who's running independent in Maine?
Graham Platner.
Right. Graham Platner goes on. He throws into relief. It's interesting how these institutions, they purport to be holding down a normative left centrism or something, are actually shown to be like out of touch with what most people think is common sense. So I hope that this aggregation of materials just throws that normative art world position, which I think is also fading. I mean, I know personally there are a lot of curators and institutions. Actually, we were just speaking with someone who's an advisor to Norway's culture ministry, and they use like the XY political compass to like look at futures. I mean, for real, like they're DNR, they're in New Models. So one thing I realized being in Venice.
We have state actors in our Discord.
No, is that like maybe we're even holding up these institutions as a bit of a straw man. Oh my gosh. Okay, we're going to get a hard cut off from a toddler.
Hey, Coco.
Hey, Coco, look who it is.
Good to see you again. Congratulations to you guys. This was an extraordinary experience. I'm so grateful for all the stuff that we get to work on together. And with the content schedule and all of these other projects, it's one of those rare opportunities where I get to see some of my best friends to do something that is really meaningful. So,
I mean, Likewise, Josh. I think with Matt and Holly, we've been in conversation about this kind of material for at least 8 years and informally for at least a decade. And it was really a joy to get to think, you know, we really had this massive session at like 3 a.m. still talking about this stuff as we're trying to deal with these objects. But yeah, anyway, congratulations to you. And thank you to Matt and Holly and the Dieto and to Sub, Julia, Bill, Stefano, who created these amazing images that will live in perpetuity, even as the t-shirts mulch in mildewed basements.
They'll be kept in a hermetically sealed, temperature-controlled environment for thousands of years.
Right. Exactly.
Thank you, Elena.
And thank you, Elena Zagas, for making this possible.
But, thank you, DHL. Thank you to the custom agents who did not look at Josh's
Thank you, Spotify. Thank you, Shopify.
Thank you, YouTube.
Shout out to Zuck. Shout out to Substack. Shout out to the American Pavilion. Better luck next time. Shout out to all the podcasters out there grinding hard, trying to live their dreams. One day it won't be embarrassing to say you're a podcaster. I promise. We're gonna make it.
All right. Thanks, gang.
Thank you, Josh.
We'll see you soon.
Ciao. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this New Model Special Report with Joshua Citarella. The online marketplace of ideas is on view at the Palazzo Dieto in Venice through November 22nd. Most of you are probably already familiar with Josh's podcast Doom Scroll, but by some chance you're not and you have an interest in how the thinking left in America is reemerging. Definitely check it out. You can find it on YouTube, Substack, Patreon, and also channel.xyz. A few announcements. If you're in Berlin on Sunday, June 21st, we'll be hosting a book launch for Trevor Paglen's How to See Like a Machine. The event is happening at the Sybil Space in Kreuzberg that evening. Trevor will be in conversation with Matt Dryhurst, me and Carly, and perhaps a few other special guests. Doors open at 7, space is limited, and it's first come, first serve. 2 days later, on Tuesday, June 23rd, I'll be giving an artist talk for Spike Magazine at Soho House Berlin, also at 7 p.m. Flyers for both should be up today. That's all for now. See you there, and see you next episode.
Rate, review, like, subscribe to New Models. Tell a friend, post about